This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, as usual. Not as always, as usual. And it is great to be with you. I hope you're having a great, great day, great week, great year. Hope everything's good with you. 713-526-5738. Going to be taking your calls just a little bit later in the show. 713-526-KPFT. Great to have Luke Jones here in the studio running the board. Luke?
Great to be here.
You're going off to college soon.
Yes, September.
I remember, Luke, when you were like 10 years old.
12, yeah.
12?
Yeah. It seems like that long ago, though.
I feel like it was more like 10. I remember you were 10 years old or 11, and you're saying 12. We did some shows, and look at this. You're ready to go off to college. How time flies. It's amazing. 713-526-5738. I want to start off today by talking about, we're going to talk about budgets today. We're going to talk about economics. That's what this show talks about. And it never goes away, right? It continues to be the news. You could call it money. Or you could call it economics. It's capital. Capital continues to be in the news in all sorts of different forms, whether we're talking about the United States economy or we're talking about the United States budget, federal budget, or we're talking about Greece, or we're talking about employment, we're talking about capital. And I have talked recently about the fact that we're spending $120 billion a year in Afghanistan in various ways, whether that's direct aid into Afghanistan, but mostly for the United States war effort in Afghanistan. Additional amounts being paid into Iraq for that effort. I don't know what that number is, but it's probably $40 billion a year, let's call it, $50 billion. So we're pushing up toward $200 billion a year. A lot of money. $200 billion a year. And the little thing I learned over the past week was that $20 billion, let's break it down a little more, and we in Houston are going to really be able to sympathize with this number. $20 billion is of that money, the $120 billion in Afghanistan and the other $50 in Iraq. $20 billion is being spent on air conditioning. Yeah. Iraq is a really hot place. kind of like Houston. Actually, it may even be hotter. You know, we see like 98, 99, 100. They actually see like 110, I think. Afghanistan, pretty warm in places too. $20 billion, I am not kidding you, is being spent. It's not funny, I shouldn't laugh. $20 billion is being spent on air conditioning for our guys and gals. Got to keep them cool. $20 billion is being spent to cool down U.S. troops in the hot places that we've sent them to. Hot in obviously more than one way. Now, I certainly don't want our troops to not have air conditioning. To me, the $20 billion expenditure on air conditioning doesn't call into question, well, you know, we should take away their air conditioning. It calls into question whether we should be there. Whether we should be spending $20 billion to send invasion forces to other parts of the world. Now, it just so happens that the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States are now kind of engaged in back and forth. Yesterday, the President gave a press conference at which he spoke very frankly, very, you know, kind of peevishly, I thought, about the Republicans. And, of course, Republicans speak about the president in that way. The president saying that it simply is inconceivable that they are going to come to some agreement unless other higher taxes, rollbacks in some cases, are made in taxes for the wealthy. And the president includes in that hedge funds. He talks about hedge funds, but what he's really talking about is the so-called carried interest, tax on carried interest. I've talked about the tax on carried interest before. If you are a hedge fund manager or a private equity or venture capital manager, you have a take of the profits of your investors. Usually that amount is 20%. You get 20% of the profits on your investors' capital. So it's not really your capital. It's your investors' capital. And there are many who believe, including me, that this income, this take, this carried interest, ought to be taxed at an income tax rate, not a capital gains tax rate. But it is taxed at a capital gains tax rate, the difference being 20%. So the president talked about that. The president clearly believes it's time for that to change. Talked about some other taxes as well. The bottom line is that I'm not the only investment advisor in the world right now. We are all investment advisors now. I mean, we are all quickly becoming investment advisors. We are all looking at the way capital is being spent in our own homes, but in our localities, in our cities, in our states, in the nation, and we're looking at the way the money is being spent. We've always been doing that. But now that we have budget crises at the governmental level, everybody's getting information coming into them. Right? I've just given you some $20 billion for air conditioning. And we are all stacking up things like that against things that we believe in. Maybe some of us believe in the air conditioning effort in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we are all measuring that $20 billion against, teachers. Let's see, how many teachers does $20 billion buy, right? Or how much health care does $20 billion buy? Or how much alternative energy infrastructure does $20 billion buy, right? Aren't you doing more of that now? Aren't you looking at the price tag of things and then what we're actually spending it on? Well, that's the investment process. The investment process is fundamentally taking an amount of capital now and putting it into a project so that you can get more out later. But the process of making that assessment invariably calls upon the notion of alternatives. This is known as an opportunity cost. What is the opportunity cost? Because if I put money into one project, by definition, I can't put it into something else. Those are mutually exclusive. Investment capital is mutually exclusive. Sad to say, but it's true. When I pick project A, by definition, I can't also pick project B with the same dollars. It's just the way it is. And so the investment process necessarily calls upon us to examine alternatives. And when we finally end up picking a project, we incur an opportunity cost. The opportunity cost is the cost of not doing project B. We will look good if project A turns out to have higher returns than project B. We will look bad if project B turns out to have higher returns than A, because we picked A. So there is the notion of opportunity cost. And I think that we are all investment advisors now looking at different projects in the same way that any investment advisor would, in the same way that any corporate finance executive would. I can make an iPhone, or I can make a this. Right? I mean, that's what they face at Apple. I can make a refinery to here or there. That's what they face at Exxon. And of course, we're now facing the examination of opportunity costs in our government's actions, government projects. If I put the $20 billion in air conditioning into Iraq, what's the opportunity cost? And there are many, many Americans who are growing awfully uncomfortable with the magnitude of the opportunity costs that we are paying. $20 billion in air conditioning into Iraq and Afghanistan to keep our guys cool versus teachers. For many people, the opportunity costs are simply getting to be too high. We're starting to wonder, how long can we continue to make what appear to us to be poor choices? How long can we continue to pay such high opportunity costs? Well, with our country carrying a very large national debt, we have borrowed. And we have borrowed because we've been unwilling to finance our projects ourselves. We find ourselves in a double bind. One, we seem to be picking projects that have low returns and we're paying opportunity costs that are too high. That is to say, we're picking worse projects over better projects. And two, we're financing it with debt, because we have not been willing to raise taxes from the population to finance these things. And in some ways, that's been part and parcel of what our government has done, and our governments have done. They've taken on debt. Right? This has been the Republican strategy. Bad projects. That's maybe the Democratic strategy, too. Bad projects, questionable projects. We're going to cut taxes. Nobody's going to feel any pain. We're going to take on debt to do it. And now what do we have? A Republican Party that says, well, no taxes. And what a horrendous debt that we have. I want to remind everybody that the portion of the budget that is being discussed and negotiated by the President, by the Congress, is discretionary spending. It's spending that comes through the general tax code through income taxes, not through specific allotments. Social Security, for example, is a specifically allotted program. You know that because you pay directly into that as a separate line item on your paycheck. You pay it on your paycheck, it goes into Social Security. There's no negotiating about that when negotiations are about discretionary spending in the general tax code. It's the same thing for Medicare. You know that because you make a separate line item payment on your paycheck or on your tax return, if you're self-employed and you pay self-employment taxes, into Medicare. I prefer those types of projects where you pay directly in. Take the city of Houston right now. We have a problem with recycling. I would like to see the city assess a separate waste management charge to all households that you would pay on your taxes. All other cities in the state of Texas, major cities, that is, do that. And apparently have no problem with it. And have better systems than we have for waste management. So when you have a governmental item that is paid directly and specifically, it's different than when you're paying into one big pot and leaving it to the guys in the parliament to divvy it up. So what's left? What's left is discretionary spending, and that's what they are talking about. Discretionary spending, of course, is a small part of all spending. The other spending being Medicare, Social Security. It's a part. And what is the largest part of discretionary spending? Do you know? It's defense. Defense is the largest part of discretionary spending. And is it not absolutely odd to you to see the President of the United States and the opposition, all of them, engaging in these talks, regardless of their positions and the good points that they may have to make about spending, or there may be waste in this program in education or that program in whatever. Road building. And to utterly ignore the elephant in the budget. That is to say, in the discretionary part of the budget, which is defense. $800 billion a year, not counting the air conditioning that I talked about, not counting the efforts in Afghanistan. Those are separate. Those are being allotted through special votes in the Congress. It simply is absolutely bizarre. The United States accounts for half of the world's military spending. We are, 2%, 3% of the world's population? We account for 50% of the world's expenditures, and we have people arguing about a pot of money and totally ignoring the largest expenditure in that pot. I shouldn't say totally. There's been some indication lately, outgoing Secretary of Defense Robert Gates made some mention about, we're gonna curve down the defense budget. And so we get back to the idea of economics. Economics is different than money. It's different than making money. We have a lot of people in this country who are focused on making money. But making money is not the same as economics. They're two totally different things. And yet what we have is a failure to act economically. Economically means that ultimately there is some net benefit that is going to accrue to all of us in the aggregate, as a community, as a society. It means that economics means household. It means that any action that we undertake has got to have some net benefit. The idea is rooted in concepts that the utilitarians in the 19th century were discussing, John Stuart Mill. There must be utility to us in the aggregate. Making money is different. Making money is parochial. individuals can make money without there being economic sense in general to the activity. Let's take hurricanes, right? Whenever we have a hurricane, right, you always see it in the news, but it should be good for the economy. We had a hurricane. Should be good for builders. Ought to really help Home Depot. Well, you and I know intuitively that a Class 5 hurricane wrecking the place is not good for economics. Right? That's not good. It's bad. It's destruction. War. World War II wasn't good economically for the world. It was good for the United States, however, because the U.S. made money. And hurricanes are good for Home Depot, and they're good for builders, and bless your hearts, I'm not trying to put you out of business or do away with hurricanes, but let's be honest. Your interests at that point are parochial, because the net loss to the economy from a hurricane, the net loss of the utility, or the lack of utility of a Class 5 hurricane, rather, trumps the parochial interests of those who make money. We are in a position now in the country where many, many parochial interests are running roughshod across the country and over the good of the whole, over the good of the community, over the good of the household. Remember, economics coming from the Greek word that means household. It's hard to see right now how those parochial interests are going to put down their push to continue to benefit. And we see parochial interests everywhere. Bloomberg reports a couple days ago, biggest tax avoiders win the most, gaming a $1 trillion U.S. tax break. Cisco Systems has cut its income taxes by $7 billion since 2005. By booking roughly half its worldwide profits at a subsidiary at the foot of the Swiss Alps that employs 100 people. You got that? Half of Cisco's worldwide profits are booked through a subsidiary that is located at the foot of the Swiss Alps that employs 100 people. Now Cisco, the largest maker of networking equipment, wants to save even more by asking Congress to waive most federal taxes due when multinationals bring such offshore earnings home. Chief Executive Officer John T. Chambers has led the charge for the tax holiday, which would be the second since 2004. He says it would encourage companies to repatriate as much as $1 trillion held abroad, spur domestic investment, and create jobs. Do you believe that? Do you believe that if Cisco is allowed to bring back the $1 trillion, it's not all Cisco's, but if companies like Cisco were allowed to bring back $1 trillion that they intend to spur domestic investment and create jobs with that money? Or do you think they intend to pay dividends to shareholders? Again, I am not indicting any company for wanting to not pay taxes. It is not the job of companies to ask for taxes. And it is not the job of companies, or any other entity for that matter, to not do what they can do within the law to pay or not pay taxes. But it is the job of our political leaders to put in place a system, a household system, an economic household system, which ensures that our highest yielding projects get funded, which ensures that we do not pay opportunity costs in the selection of projects, which ensures that those projects, projects A, that have higher returns than projects B, get funded. That is the job of the organizers of a political economy. And I can't help but think that our founding fathers and our founding mothers understood that more than they understood anything else. That they were creating a political economy. And that it was incumbent upon them to create a political economy which would create opportunity not just through ideas like liberty and freedom, but would create a political economy through a system that helped and facilitated the prioritization of valuable opportunities and projects. How we got from there to air conditioning $20 billion worth in Afghanistan and Iraq, I don't, well, maybe I sort of know. I'm not sure I completely know or want to know. But we're a long, long way, I agree with the Tea Party, from those founding fathers who understood political economy. The problem I have with the Tea Party, the problem I have with Republicans, is that you won't say anything about $20 billion worth of air conditioning. You are silent, and your leaders are silent. It's not acceptable. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your call, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. It is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, and we'll be back in just a moment. All right. Here we are. That was a quick one, Luke. Thanks. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. Let's go to line one and take Mark. Hey, Mark. Welcome.
Hi. Before I get to my point, I just wanted to say that if we allow the corporations to come back, bring their money back with without paying the taxes that they are due, they'll do exactly like they did the last time. They'll pass the money on as dividends and capital gains. The top 2% wage earners will be the great beneficiaries of that money, and they will not use that money to create jobs just like they haven't done since 2000, and they'll just reinvest their money for themselves. And, you know, it's just a vicious cycle. So,
Mark, the estimates, you know, coming out of the crisis of 2008 and the recession, the estimates were that American corporations held $1.7 trillion of cash on their balance sheets. Cash. I think that number has grown since then. And the concern is, okay, you've got all this money. When are you going to invest it? Where are you going to invest it? What are you waiting for to invest it in? And I think that the point that you make, which is what's in front of us that would tell us, I mean, maybe we'd be willing to give you this tax holiday if, in fact, there was some guarantee that that's what you were going to do with the money. But your point is that there is no guarantee of that. And in fact, there's a history that it may not happen.
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, you look at history. What is the motivation for them, once they've been given that approval and that guarantee, what is their motivation to do anything more than pass it on to their investors? There is no motivation to do other than that.
Or to pay their executives.
And, well, that's it. Yeah, that's
and,
exactly
and,
right.
And what we've seen, you know, what we've seen with executive pay, in my opinion, is absolutely tied in with large cash hoards because executive pay has been going absolutely crazy for the last 20 and 30 years. I mean, there's been Washington Post ran an article about this recently saying, you know, the gap between executives and what other people are paid in corporations is staggering and didn't exist in the 1970s. And they profiled one executive who worked in the 1970s. The guy got paid $1 million, which is a lot of money, and said he was embarrassed at getting paid that. You don't have any kind of shame like that with executives. And so the more money that piles up in corporations, the more of it that is paid out to executives. And it's a big problem. Big problem.
Well, and also, I mean, just follow the money. I mean, look who is promoting this idea and see if these corporations are not making political contributions to these politicians.
Right, right, right.
I mean, it's there. I mean, just like with the Sanctuary City bill, all of a sudden the Republicans are balking because Perry Holmes and other corporations are saying, wait a minute, you know, you're going to be hurting our cheap labor. The corporations are controlling everything. They're making the decisions for our politicians.
Yeah. Mark, great to have you. Thanks for the
call.
Thank you. Very valuable points. Ed Kleinbard, a law professor at University of Southern California at USC, was a former corporate tax attorney at Cleary Gottlieb, big, big firm. He says, why should we reward firms for successfully gaming the tax system when we, in turn, are called upon to make up the missing tax revenues? Much of these earnings overseas are reaped from an enormous shell game. Firms move their taxable income from the U.S. and other major economies, where their customers and key employees are in reality located, to tax havens. John Earnhardt, who's a spokesman for Cisco, says Cisco complies with all global tax laws. And probably he's right. He's probably right. They probably, everything they're doing is probably legal. And that's the problem. That is the entire problem. In an organized political economy that is interested in projects, return on capital, and the ability to send signals to investors about how to prioritize their investments. You know, you've got different rules. And the rules we have now seem to be dissuading us from making investment. 713-526-5738. Next is David. David, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Good afternoon, Leo.
How are you?
I'm very well.
What's on your mind?
Just wanted to affirm your talk about the federal budget and how money is being spent and how taxes were decreased 10 years ago, and now they're coming back saying, well, we don't have any money, so we've got to cut expenses. The same thing has been done at the state level.
Right.
Back in 2006, they changed the school funding formula and reduced school property taxes by a third. They changed the franchise tax to make up the difference, and that has never made up the difference.
Yes, this was the you're talking about here in Texas, and the change.
Yes.
The change there was that no longer were things like limited partnerships exempted from taxes. Right, prior to the change, limited partnerships were exempt from taxes, but now they have a $1 million revenue exemption, and so any. You know, many entities that are under $1 million in revenues are exempted from paying state franchise taxes. And I think what you're referring to is, as a result, it hasn't changed much.
Well, right. Well, basically, I don't think that's the real reason why there's a disparity. I mean, what they're doing is they're exempting small businesses from the franchise tax, essentially. But they did change it to a margin tax. And you could be running a deficit in your business and still be forced to pay the margin tax, and it, you know, the $1 million cutoff, so to speak, doesn't help companies that have maybe large amount of sales but a very small margin. It's kind of a silly exemption. But if you look at the records, the last 5 years, the disparity between the additional franchise tax that's been collected and the school spending for the state has been about $20 billion, which is close to that deficit they were talking about. But even worse, if you look at the state balance sheet, they have about a $40 billion surplus, and about $30 billion of that has been garnered in the last 10 years. So this deficit they keep referring to, I believe that it's a false deficit.
Mm-hmm.
It is a deficit in a per biennium kind of mode.
Right.
But there is plenty of money, It's highly liquid, the $40 billion that I'm talking about, and they're refusing to even discuss it, much less use it.
And where do you think Texans are on this? What knowledge do you think Texans in general have about, we're talking about the state legislature. What do you think the understanding of Texans in general is about the state government and its funding, budgetary methods, processes, and current condition?
Well, I don't think they have a clue. None of the major media has reported any of this, and I took it upon myself to do a study of the financial statements of the state of Texas for the last 10 years, and that's where I came up with this differential and how they're actually gaming us with regard to this discussion. But as far as anybody knowing about it, you know, you and I are talking about it right now, but I don't think very many other people are.
Yeah,
so,
and the aim is, of course, to cry poor and cut programs that other people value.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's the only thing I can infer from what's been going on.
Great to have you, David. Thanks for the information and the
right.
And the call. 713-526-5738. 526 KPFT. We are talking about economics, money, taxes. You know, I pay my taxes, and I would be happy to pay my taxes if I knew that what I was paying my taxes for were good causes, good projects, right? I mean, that's all any of us wants, to know about our tax payments, that they are going to good projects. And, you know, in some cases I feel that way, but in a lot of cases I don't feel that way. Especially at the federal level, where so much is going into this area called defense, where the numbers are just so enormous on a regular basis. And I know that when I write an income tax check, it's going into this military complex. How do you feel? You getting your money's worth there? Should we be cutting other things and not cutting there? 713-526-5738. John is up next. John, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hey, good afternoon, Leo.
Good afternoon to you.
All right. The first caller, he mentioned something about corporations taking over government, and I think that's a problem. Would you name for me one president who's ever been an economist? Because what you're saying is absolutely correct, but if you look at all the presidents, they've been nothing short of lawyers and corporate lawyers and businessmen, and they represent the corporations, most of them. So they
careful what you ask for, John. careful what you wish for.
right.
No,
but
I'm
technically,
kidding.
we keep having elections, hoping that things are going to change. But the reality is, what you're saying is, you're an economist. You make sense. But they're into not making any sense. They're into passing the buck and just doubling down on everything that is wrong.
Yeah.
If you look at what Dick Cheney said, he said deficits don't matter just 6 years ago.
Right.
So if it didn't matter 6 years ago, why are the same Republicans now all of a sudden throwing their arms up and raising hell about deficits all of a sudden?
Right.
Is it because they're not in power, that's why they care? And as soon as they get in power, they'll go back to the Dick Cheney analogy of deficits don't matter?
Deficits do matter. You know, we have to be clear with ourselves that it's not that everything that Republicans and conservatives say is not right. Yes, deficits matter. They are important. But what is debt? What does it mean when you get a car loan or an education loan? It means you're taking on a deficit. It means that you don't have capital, but you have a good project. So someone who supplies you with a loan is supplying you with money, capital, that you don't have to complete a project that is worthy.
Right,
so when you take on debt, you need to do so for absolutely, really good projects, and so it's not always about there being debt or deficits.
Right.
We have
so
to look at the asset side of the balance sheet, and Republicans have decided that every little governmental program that they look at that they don't like you know, is going to have to get cut and is the problem here. But they absolutely will not look at defense.
Right. And so, in other words, every time you apply for any credit, they must look at your ability to pay back whatever deficit you're trying to borrow.
Right. That's
but,
right.
The problem is we have a political system that is incapable of checking itself. On one side, there's the Democratic Party, which is like the little sensible Republican Party. And on the other side, there's the Republican Party, which absolutely has no common sense or whatever it has. And in the middle, there's the people who pay taxes, who absolutely have no voice and no say in where the tax dollars are going.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of us who have questions about the... who have questions about the American system right now. Call it what you will. Many, many good things about it. But there are questions about the ability of the American system to move forward with a renovation of our political economy. You know, we're considering a coal-fired power plant in Matagorda County at a time when we could be increasing clean energy in the state of Texas, and that is happening. But we have a state government that's ready to green light a coal-fired power plant at a time when all indications are that coal-fired power plants are a thing of the past.
Like what I was reading in Germany, why is it that in Germany, for instance, after the Fukushima problem in Japan, they actually have the nerve to go ahead and eradicate all the nuclear power plants, and they're going for greener energy? Why is it that they're capable of making these tough decisions that... It's so eluding the American the country that
well Germany's in a very luxurious position right now, John. Germany is a surplus nation and a nation of savers, and a nation that since the Second World War and the disastrous, catastrophic actions that Germany took has emerged from that as a far more constructive nation. It's also a nation that doesn't have the military expenditures that we have, and so it is able to dedicate itself to projects that I think are higher returning projects. Of course, it's got a problem in Greece right now, and the news today is that German banks have agreed to roll over Greek debt, you know, to throw that debt over into the future 30 years forward. So it's not that Germany doesn't have issues, but Germany is a rock and center of fiscal rectitude in Europe.
Okay,
so Germany's in a very different position than we are, and we should be looking at Germany for some pointers.
But what makes them be capable of doing what they're doing? They didn't have to get rid of their nuclear plants, but they're doing it. What makes them see common sense that is not there in this country anymore?
John, it's not for me to say whether they should or shouldn't get rid of nuclear power plant. You know, you get a lot of disagreement and on nuclear power. And so, but the focus should be on what can we in the world learn from other people. And that's what we should be seeking to learn in the United States. We should be seeking to learn how do other countries who do health care well, how do they do that? How do other countries who do investment surplus well, Germany, for example, how do they do that well, or China, for example? What do we have to teach people? But when we become closed-minded about how we can convert ourselves and learn, that's when we get in trouble. And that's what worries me, is when our nation is not opening up to others and how we can transform our political economy. To me, that's when we get in trouble. So that would be my answer, is that nobody's got all the answers, but being open and remaining open to new information is critical. And I'm not sure that our leaders are in that position. They don't sound to me like they're open to new information.
Well, that's the problem I was saying. You know, nothing seems to... They don't have solutions. It's all about blame game, and
right.
we're not learning anything.
And they have such preconceived notions that they've locked down on that it's very, very hard to get them to see new things. And that's when you're really going to make wrong turns. John, great to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
713-526-5738. It's the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host, and we are wrestling with you know, I think the issues of the day. In this country, is it the Congress? It's easy to blame Congress, but at some point we have to blame, I don't want to say blame, at some point we have to look at ourselves and say we've got to make change starting at home. We've got to make change starting with ourselves. That's really where it's got to begin. 713-526-5738. Next up, let's take Janae. Is it Janae or Janie? You there? Nope. Okay, let's move on to Gary on line one. Gary, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great.
I want to, I'm just an ordinary citizen. And
as am I.
I have noticed some interesting juxtapositions lately.
Mm-hmm.
In the paper for the last year has been the story about the CEO salaries, where a single human being makes millions of dollars in a year, more than most of us will make in 20 years.
Right.
A hundred years.
Vast amounts.
Wait, I got to get to my story here.
Yep.
Okay, so we got CEO salaries in the millions, more than most of us will make in two or three lifetimes. And then I hear Michelle Bachmann saying that, we need to get rid of the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hear about corporate profits in the billions, I mean billions of dollars. And people are talking about cutting Medicare and Social Security. And now I see that Pelosi, who's on the Democratic side, is literally worth millions of dollars. I don't want to go into conspiracy theories here, but has our country gone completely insane? How can certain people make millions and millions of dollars, and the rest of us are living on, you know, paycheck to paycheck? Is there something wrong here?
Gary, the idea of the conservative movement is that you are responsible for all that happens to you, good or bad. That is the world view.
Well, that's the point, but I've been working as a manager for 30 years in an industrial company, and I have maybe enough to last until I die, but I haven't made $1 million.
Right, and so
how does that work?
That's the world view. The world view is that you are responsible, and a corporate executive who gets everything that they get is they're responsible. And to me, we've got to move beyond the world view of it's mine. I mean, I was on my way to work this morning, and I was thinking, you know, I like my job, I like what I do, I like my life, but I'm not responsible for that whole thing, right? It has come down to me through all sorts of lucky things that have happened, in having an education and being born in this time, in this place. And there are many in our system who don't enjoy the same sort of fate that I've enjoyed. And I've got a great community here at KPFT, and I get to go on the radio. But there are many people who are in systems in the world.
But wait, that's the same old story, okay? You work,
no.
You dig a ditch, you make $2 an hour.
Right.
You work for a corporation, you make $100 an hour. But we're talking disparities in millions and billions here.
Yes.
I mean, this is insanity.
Right, but that is the end game, the end result of a worldview, of a philosophy that sees simply the gain of the spoils as proof unto itself that they are deserved.
Okay, then explain to me, if you have more money than you could ever, or your children or your grandchildren could spend in your entire freaking lives,
mm-hmm.
I mean, buying yachts and corporate jets and Ferraris, why would anybody be opposed to paying any kind of tax to help their own freaking country
that
survive?
That's the big question. That is exactly the question. Well, it is up to the population to say.
I think it's a test by God to see how greedy we really are. Is that possible?
Gary, it's an idea. Great to have you on. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
You know, that is the idea of a progressive tax system. And I don't mean progressive, and I just mean a logical tax system that achieves positive results. And positive results to me, as you've been hearing today, are measured in losing lower opportunity cost projects and engaging in higher opportunity projects. And so that is the question, is will our system of taxation provide for returning some of these dollars to the system and directing them into areas of investment that are worthy of investment? I'm okay with the private sector doing all of that. But as we talked about earlier in the show, the private sector is sitting on trillions of dollars of cash, a lot of it offshored in other countries, in tax havens. That's not working. That capital is not getting replenished in our system so that we can pursue the projects that we have, regardless of what you think they are. I think they're teachers, and I think they are urban transit systems, and I think they are recycling systems, so we quit wasting the vast amount of things that we're wasting in material. Those are high return projects. I think more social workers and remediation of substance abuse rather than incarceration. I mean, I can describe the society I would like to see. But first, we all have to, for us to take action together, we all have to agree, yes, that's the society that I would like to see. And we've got a lot of people, I think, who aren't quite sure what they want to see in society other than, you know, they need more money, exactly as Gary was saying. That, ultimately, is a loser. That's not a winning society, in my judgment. More money. Again, that's money. That's not economics. That, and those two things are very, very different. Okay, let's go back to the phones and take let's take a new caller, JR, maybe on line 3. Hey JR, welcome to the show.
Hello Leo, thank you very much.
Pleasure to take your call. What's on your mind?
I'm one of these people who agrees with you that the defense budget is way too big. Mm-hmm. In fact, most every military expert I'm aware of thinks the defense budget should probably be about half the size it is.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is we always see that from these experts in the military, too. You make a great point that when you talk to experts kind of deep within, they concede.
Now, the other thing I liked in your discussion was, you know, you like to avoid the politically charged words. You like the idea of a logical tax system. You don't particularly care whether it's called progressive or not.
Right, that's right.
Well, in the defense budget in particular, what is astonishing is how totally out of whack the logic is.
Yeah.
For the first thing we do is that we've essentially never taken the Second and Third Amendment seriously. If we had, we would have the foundation of our military institutions and our electoral system would be a militia like Switzerland.
Very interesting.
That's what those people were copying in 1789.
See, in a way, this is where liberals and the Tea Party could come together, which is, let's get rid of the army.
Yes.
We're going to have militias. Maybe the compromise go ahead.
It's not militias. In Switzerland, there's only one militia.
Yeah, right.
And you're drafted when you're born, mm-hmm. and you report when you're 18.
To the militia. You report to the militia.
To the militia. And you can be a Roman Catholic, you can be a Protestant, you can be an evangelical, you can speak Italian, German, or French.
Mm-hmm.
You go to barrack school at 18,
yeah.
and you learn to be a Swiss national.
Yeah.
Same thing in Israel. In this country, we've never actually had that. The Third Amendment, nobody even knows what it means. The Second Amendment's been turned into a joke. And we've never actually had anything like the military institutions of a republic. We have the military institutions of the British monarchy.
Right, and when everyone is serving, then everyone has to really decide if you want to go fight over here or there or wherever.
It's ferocious. I mean, you ought to listen to military debates in Israel, where left-wing communists tend to be colonels of rangers.
Yeah,
you got that. You don't. There's no aesthetic dimension to it. There's not really an ideological dimension to it. It tends to be extremely practical. Anyway, with that pretty fundamental flaw. What we have is an imbalance between pork and ordnance. Almost all of the military budget is stuff that doesn't and never will have any effect on military preparedness at all.
Much less defense, much less things that are defense-oriented. They tend to be offense-oriented.
No, it's real estate values in certain parts of the country. That's what's dramatically affected.
Yeah.
You got that? And the other trade-offs go on down between ordnance and operations. We don't actually spend that much on operations. And really, I mean, the amount that we're spending on two wars is going down. But the defense budget is going up. You got that?
Yeah. Oh, I know that.
And within the operational sector, the very peculiar thing that traces back to Cheney and Rumsfeld and what I would call the chicken hawk mentality is the mix of actual soldiers and mercenaries and contractors is like nothing this country has ever seen.
Yeah.
You got that? And incidentally, that's the origin of some figure for air conditioning.
Yeah.
I mean, really, soldiers are pretty good with sleeping in tents. You
yeah.
got that? Actually, the people who understand the nature of the wars we're fighting think that you should sleep in the police station with the Afghan soldiers you're working with.
JR, great to have you. Thanks
wait,
for the
wait,
call.
Wait.
No, I got to move along.
Contractors.
I got to move on, JR. Thanks so much for the call. Great to have you, and very, very interesting. I just got a few minutes left, so I want to get some more calls in. Scott's been holding the longest. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Next year is an opportunity to elect a new senator from Texas. Now, do enough Texans want to seriously address this country's problems? I don't think they can do it by electing another Republican senator.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, we like electing Republicans in Texas, or a lot of us do, and they're doing it, and we'll see what happens with the state. I strongly disagree with many of the directions that the party is taking us in, but I don't agree with all the things the Democrats are doing either. I mean, we lack sort of a visionary party right now in many ways.
Okay.
And we need one. We could really use a really visionary party. Maybe that's a Green Party. Maybe that's I know Tea Party likes to think of itself as visionary, but just I'm sort of lacking. I believe that we are lacking in a true visionary party right now. We could use one.
Well, I've been active in the Democratic Party for a long time, and I push what I think needs to be done. And
yeah.
I think the Democratic Party is what you make it.
That's true. You're right.
And the filing deadline, I think, is early this December, and the primary is in March.
Scott, thanks for the call. Great to have you as always.
Thank you.
Time for maybe, what do you think, Luke? One more call? Can we take one?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's go. Let's take Jose. Jose, welcome.
Hi. I'm going to go ahead and I'll try to make it quick. But
you
just one, I want to make 2 points. First is that talking about the Tea Party, I think a lot of people don't realize that the Tea Party is here to stay. And my fear is that the Tea Party, and I haven't heard any of the political pundits talk about this, is I think that the Tea Party is going to become our version of Le Pen in France.
It's fine for the it's not for me to say what stays or doesn't stay. We can call ourselves what we want, and we can stay or not stay. Ultimately, we have to have a set of principles around which we can have a discussion.
Absolutely.
And those principles ought to be economic principles, where
right.
where return on capital, full costs, all those things
yeah.
that we talk about on this show, and that ought to be in common. But we can't lie to ourselves. We can't
yes.
say
we can't say
$20 billion in air conditioning in Afghanistan
absolutely.
is going to work.
Right. And I just want to make one more point. And I know you have to wrap it up. And that is I think one of the dangers, especially with the Democrat with the Republicans, is that the Republicans have turned into a nativist party. And I see that the hardcore within the Republican Party, they're like they remind me of old school Marxists. There's only black and white and no gray in between, and they are the most ideologically rigid people that this country has.
Got to stay open to new information.
Thank you.
Jose,
bye.
Thanks for the call. Michael, I'm sorry we didn't get to you. We ran out of time. Luke, thank you so much. It's great to have you here today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Working the board and helping me out. We will be back next week. I'll be back next week. NewCapitalShow.com, and please friend me on Facebook at LeoGold.NewCapitalShow. That's LeoGold.NewCapitalShow. On Facebook. Until next week, stay cool and take care.
Celebrate spring with the Discovery Green Thursday free concert series, showcasing outstanding regional performers, presented by Capital One Bank and co-sponsored by KPFT. Discovery Green is Houston's number one spot to picnic on the grass. dance on the patio, and watch the sunset over the gorgeous downtown skyline. Bring your family, meet your friends, or disconnect the kids from their video games to show them some real Guitar Heroes. The series concludes on Thursday, June 30th, featuring Bean Spartan and the Bipeds, a Houston musical and visual institution for over 25 years. This concert is a St. Arnold recycling night, so bring your empty six-pack containers to double your St. Arnold reward points. The show starts at 6:30 and everyone is welcome. Street parking is mostly free starting at 6. Bring your picnics, blankets, and lawn chairs, but leave your glass containers and alcohol at home. Don't worry, food, wine, and beer are also available at the Lake House Restaurant. Visit discoverygreen.com for more information. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.